X is for Podcast Mutants, Magic, and Marvels is brought to you by the Cage Club Network. So for all things media, check out cageclub.me. That's cageclub.me. And for all things X is for Podcast, check out X is for Podcast on Twitter and YouTube. Hey everybody, welcome back to another all-new X's for Podcast, your premier comic podcast for modern Marvels, Chronoskimming, classics, and more. I'm Nico, and you guys can find me Chronoskimming around the internet at Nico Action. That's N-I-C-O-A-C-T-I-O-N on Twitter and Instagram. Today we have an awesome doubleheader for you. We're going to kick things off with an amazing interview with a phenomenal writer and artist, Jason Lowe, whose work on X-Men Unlimited, as well as many other places throughout the Marvel Universe this past year, has totally stolen our hearts. And then we're going to take a look at Chronoskimming, one of our favorite classic stories, Asgardian Wars, which, for the first time, we're noticing a little bit more wear and tear on the story than we'd expected, but we can't wait to talk to you guys about it. Kicking things off, though, is that phenomenal interview with Jason Lowe, and we hope you guys enjoy it just as much as we enjoyed making it. And don't forget, if you guys like what you hear, you might even like what you see, so give us a subscribe over on Twitter at X's for Podcast. Hey everybody, welcome back to X is for Podcast, your premier comics podcast for modern Marvels, Chronoskimming, classics, and more. I'm Nico, and you guys can find me snickting along on Twitter and Instagram at Nico Action. That's N-I-C-O-A-C-T-I-O-N.
And I'm TK. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at XNateXGrayX.
And I'm Nathan. You can find me online at Dazzler AOA at Twitter. That's Dazzler, like in the Age of Apocalypse.
And I am unlimitedly excited for our guest today. We have been such a huge fan of this creator's work on our show for the last few months. We're really excited to welcome Jason Lowe to the show.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
Woo!
Yeah, so honored that you guys like my work.
Oh, man, do we ever. We are such big Lila fans and Robbie Reyes fans and very certainly some Madrox Guido fans over here. So it was just really exciting to connect with a lot of your really great Unlimited stories. Do you want to tell us a little bit how you got into writing? Your origin story. What would you put in your 22-page, this is how I started writing comics?
Oh, well, I started making comics ever since I've read, or at least like just looked at the pictures of comics since I was like 4 years old. But I think I attempted to like make my own comic strips when I was like 12 years old, around a time when like Caroline in the City show was on air, seeing Leah Thompson play a cartoonist in New York. And I was like, you know, like maybe I can make a living as a cartoonist. Like that looks awesome.
Okay. You're speaking 90s sitcom heroines. That is totally this show's vibe.
Oh,
1,000%.
Okay.
Suddenly, Susan, you're interesting. It is 1,000% our wheelhouse.
I also just have to throw out there that Leah Thompson was just on an episode of the Unbeatable Squirrel Girl podcast. So this is a really full circle moment.
Oh, whoa, I gotta check that out.
It's really fantastic.
That show inspired me to make my own comic strips, knowing that like you have to have like a backlog of work before it gets published. So I thought like if I get like 20 comic strips done, maybe I can like show them to the Toronto Star or our local newspaper and they'll print it for me when I'm like 12 years old and make money out of that. After that, I was making like mini comics, printing them off Xeroxed at a local Business Depot, which is now Staples, and selling them at the high school cafeteria among my friends. Doing the same thing in college, I studied interpretive illustration, hoping that I could learn the craft of comics, but they kind of frowned upon the art of comics in the early 2000s. They mostly focused on editorial and technical illustration. I found like the right mentors when I interned at Raid Studios. Raid Studios is a local communal studio. Originally, it was shared by four comic artists and illustrators that consisted of Kagan McLeod, Ben Shannon, Cameron Stewart, and a guy named Stephen Murray, who everyone now knows as Chip Zdarsky. I have him to thank for opening some of the doors for me in the last few years.
Did you also grow up watching the X-Men animated series? Because it seems like you maybe have because of that deep love of some of the comics continuity you seem to have from your writing, or?
Oh, of course. Yeah, 1992 X-Men. I was 10 years old. I was at the right age. I was more aware career of the X-Men through the Pride of X-Men, like the early X-Men cartoon with Dazzler and Kitty Pryde, Nightcrawler, and followed by the 6-player arcade game. And walking into an arcade and you see like 5 other people already playing and they need a 6th person, you're like, all right, I'm going to jump on. I love those moments. Or, you know, like you start off playing it yourself and then slowly other people start to join you and then you try to finish the game all together.
That arcade game, I wasn't cool enough to get anybody else but Dazzler, so that started my love of Dazzler. So,
I mean, she's arguably the best character in that game, so I think you probably were the coolest.
Yeah, I was more a fan of Nightcrawler because I liked how he would zip through, like, across the screens. I was like, oh, that's awesome.
The game also just really has the most iconic villains.
I have to ask, because you brought up Dazzler, sort of, kind of. We got it there. We made it happen. So.
Yay.
Yeah.
Ooh.
You changed our destiny, bro. You wrote this story about Guido and Madrox, so I'm doing my strong guy research. And then out comes your, my, like, absolutely one of my absolute favorite things to come out of Unlimited ever, your Lila Cheney story. And so I'm flipping through the annals of the Marvel Universe, and I come across that they share this appearance called Spellbound. And I'm like, well, what in the fuck is this? And so I find out what in the fuck it was. And it was a Wheezy Simonson fever dream about sorcerers crossing galaxies and destroying universes just to punish bad little Dungeons and Dragons imps. And like, we loved it so much, we dedicated like 3 episodes to it. And it's 6 issues of madness. And it's incredible. And we would have never had it if not only had you told these great stories that you told, but I hadn't done the anal retentive research to discover it's just a truly incredible 6 issues.
I haven't even dived that deep into Spellbound. The funny thing is, like, I only found out about Spellbound the same time when I was writing it. I didn't know Lila Cheney was on it. Most of my experience with her was from early appearances of New Mutants, some of the random issues that she appeared in the 1990s X-Factor run. That's all I based it off of. I think it's kind of cool to work with a character that has been less explored because there's a lot of great possibilities to play around with a character like that, as opposed to someone like Wolverine, who's practically done everything. I thought, wouldn't it be neat to like just throw Lila Cheney in a scenario that we've never seen before, and that is a reality dating show.
But it feels like something that is so plausible for her life and existence. She's got a voice here that is kind of new and unique and refreshed, because she's really not a character that we get to see very often. So each time she comes up, you sort of do have to do the legwork of giving her a voice that has a current zeitgeist context. I was wondering if you had really any specific goals or intentions when it came to both pulling from the old stuff and sort of putting your own stamp on Lila, because it really does come off as this is still totally Lila, but she has those hallmarks of being a present day character and not, you know, an 80s punk pop star.
She started out as a conniving character that tried to sell the world. So she's definitely someone that kind of in it for herself, but you know, like she does have a lot of heart when it comes to sticking up for her friends or her fellow mutants. I know that she's British, but I figured that, you know, for most British pop stars, like especially ones that like would tour mostly around like North America, like maybe that accent kind of gets a bit watered down a bit, more westernized. There was a bit of balance of trying to not sound too cockney, just right.
I mean, I think you absolutely nail it. And it's so good to see her like this. All of the exports from characters that have more than just their powers to send out into the world. I mean, Dazzler is obviously the most obvious example, but we see it happening with Pyro too, who is now publishing his novels and going on a book tour. But then we've got Lila, who both on top of being a recognized musician is also kind of this interstellar jet setter. So there's always this interest in what she could possibly be doing that is both associated with this cool time for the X-Men, but also kind of spinning off into all of her own adventures. And I think just in this one, you know, Infinity Comics slice of her life, we get so much for this character that feels right for this era.
Oh yeah, totally. Especially like in the Krakoa age where like all the mutants can, like good or evil, they can just kind of relax. They've landed on paradise. So like they don't need to fight each other anymore. And when there's that rule where like they can't kill any humans, I feel that most mutants just want to just live their daily life. Like, some of them don't need to be a superhero like the X-Men. Someone like Layla Cheney, like, she can just focus on her true passion, which is just making punk rock music and just touring across the galaxy.
Odd turn of events for her. She had to follow in Dazzler's footsteps, where Dazzler used to follow in her footsteps before. I got to say, like, how fun it was to see that. And, like... the outfit y'all chose for that was amazing. Like, I love that outfit. And just, like, her date outfit, so good. Like, this is such a fun idea. I would pay for, like, a 10-issue maxi series.
Yeah, I mean, it would totally be a lot of fun to expand that issue. You only get a certain amount of panels per issue. We try to cram as much in there. When I was pitching ideas for X-Men Unlimited, originally, I wanted to do a Dazzler story, but I was told that her dance card was full by the editors. So I had to find like another alternative, and Layla Cheney was a great alternative, but actually it worked out for the better because I think it made the story much more interesting. If we actually had Dazzler in an episode like that, things would have just worked out very conventionally. Whereas in Layla, she doesn't take any BS. If she knows like something's off with the date, she would just call it off. She's not into like finding love that way. Her main focus is music. So I think that adds an interesting, sweeter dynamic to the story.
So perfect how you've got her character down, because when you pick her up over all of these different random appearances, like, have that same sort of like connectiveness with the material, and you were able to like have her shine and, like TK said, updated kind of way, but it's true to her core.
Oh, good. I'm only using the little research that I have of her. It's kind of funny that at the same time when my story came out featuring her, that Marvel came up with an article, like a whole write-up about the character. So for people that download that issue of X-Men Unlimited and you're like, who the hell is Layla Cheney? And at least Marvel can go, well, check out this article. And they gave like a very good, thorough biography of her. A lot of the stuff were things I touched on in the issue that I wrote. Lauren Emro, who's my editor, let me know that like this is like a very D-list character. Try to give the readers a heads up, a reminder of who she is. And it's like, I think I have a pretty clever way of how to let people know her history and have it be told in the opening credits.
I tried to write down like all of the hot ass cameos. We have Dazzler, we have Carol, we have Guido, we have Sam, so many fucking stars. And then Wind Dancer and Shark Girl show up like it's no big deal. Like this is the best mutant awards or something. And yet with this top tier talent, we're talking like grade A fire, right? You give us my favorite fucking mutant of 2022. Yes. Sites, who is the sweetest boy and is the goodest mutant. So much. He is 1000%. We are Team Sites. And we only wish that there was more Sites than Unlimited 28. He is just such a sweet guy. I hope he starts popping up all over the Green Lagoon because, frankly, you know, Annalie is a sweet boy, but he's a little young. So, but Sites, he's clearly Safe Serve certified, right? So I think he could be a really good fit throughout Krakoa.
Yeah, I hope so too. And Fred Dukes, he definitely needs all the help he can get at the Green Lagoon, so why not add a new character? And I thought, like, man, it's just so heartwarming that to introduce a new character into the Marvel Universe and seeing all the positive responses. Originally, he was supposed to be like the guy that would be paired up with Layla Cheney at the end, but I was like, that does not make sense throughout, because like the whole story, Layla is not here for love. It doesn't have to end with everyone falling in love, but everyone being in a better place than they were before.
It would have been very forced to have her fall in love at the end of this, and that would not really have been her style. The Jubilee piece you did with Christina Strain in Voices Identity, how did that come about?
That story was probably the second or third project that I did with Marvel. So when I got hired by Marvel, I got hired by Tom Brevoort, the senior VP. He found one of my samples online.
The Amazing Madrock story.
Yeah, exactly.
We were talking about how much we love that before you got in the room.
Yeah.
I love it.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. A friend of mine showed it to Dan Slott, and Dan Slott like retweeted it going like, oh my God, this is amazing. And Tom found it and he was like, I got to have this in my book. I don't know how it's going to work, but we'll figure that out. Yeah, he reached out to me and introduced me to a bunch of editors, and one of those editors happened to be Darren Shan, who was working on Marvel Voices, and he he asked me if I would be interested in doing a Jubilee story. I'm like, dude, like, Jubilee is in my top three favorite Marvel characters of all time. My top three Marvel characters: Multiple Man, Jubilee, and Ben Grimm Thing. I checked off all those three characters off my bucket list with my first three projects for Marvel. I'm very content to work on a Jubilee story where we got to dive deep into her family history. Just a bit about, like, more insight about her parents, because we hardly see them, or they're hardly talked about. Because, you know, we forget that, especially in the cartoons, that she's Asian. Like, she's Chinese. It was just great to really focus on that part of her life that should make her Jubilation Lee. Christina Strand, like, she wrote a wonderful, very touching script about Jubilee remembering her mom and dad. I had lots of fun just drawing the kinds of foods that we would see in their family dinner table. I just relished in every detail of that. Christina Strand, who also colored it, she even relished it even more, and she just made my art so perfect for that story.
The team of the two of you is amazing on this. I mean, I read Christina's Generation X, so I was like, oh my gosh, I'm so excited for this Jubilee story. But, like, just with your art, I was like, blew away any expectations for something I was already super excited.
I'm like so open to doing another collaboration with Christina Strand. Like, I know she's busy working in TV land right now, but if she ever wants to take some time to, like, write another Jubilee story and color it, I'll be her artist.
It was hands down one of the best Jubilee stories I've read ever. I think the best one that I can think of as a single one issue kind of thing.
Well, and it was really great too, because it was coming out of the time where she's in Excalibur, and it's a fantastic run for her in Excalibur. But to get this moment of her internal life, her romantic life, and her remembering her parents is really beautiful, because even though she's an awesome team member on Excalibur and she's really fun, it is a very kind of action-oriented book, and the personal stuff isn't really Jubilee stuff. It's mostly, if there's anything Jubilee-related, it really has more to do with Shogo. So to get this little break where we get this heartfelt moment that sort of, in a lot of ways, harkens back to the Jubilee that we remember from the 90s, who was just this kid who really needed love and family and didn't have that. The timing was perfect for this particular story especially, and it's exactly what she deserves for so many of us, because she's so many people our age, she was our lead-in character to the X-Men.
It's a lot of fun working on Jubilee.
She's awesome. That's all we need to do.
She is awesome.
Yeah.
I need to thank you personally, because my second favorite is Robbie Reyes, and so I need to go out of my way to be like, thank you for showing Robbie love. These Unlimited comics have been great for Robbie, and you've been playing so beautifully in the X-Men's Unlimited sandbox. I would love to know how you wound up writing what is just inexplicably the sweetest Robbie story. You know, he's not somebody that you associate with driving around his younger brother everywhere. It just, we loved covering that story, and Robbie is my favorite. It's just such a great character, and as a Latino guy, it's just so exciting to get to see a Latino character be so about family in a way that is really positively reflective of strong core values, as opposed to, like, he feels stuck with this kid. And, like, it was just a great story. So I just want to thank you, because I'm such a big Robbie guy. How did that story come to be?
Annalise, the editor, reached out to me asking if I would be interested in working on a couple of Marvel holiday comics. At the time, I was already set to work on, like, several X-Men Unlimited comics, and I was already, like, deep in work, so I was like, I don't know if I can commit too much, but let me write one holiday story. The two holidays that were assigned to me were the Lunar New Year, which had a very shorter deadline for me, which I wish I could have done, but the people that did it did a spectacular job. And then the other one was a Valentine's story. Let me think of some Marvel couples that I can do a story with, and you can always look at, like, Reed Richards and Sue Storm, or Luke Cage and Jessica Jones. But then I was like, I want to do something that hasn't been done before, and I think it would stand out being very unique, and it will show a lot of heart if I focused on someone like, not Robbie Reyes, but Gabe Reyes, the little brother. This is actually a Gabe Reyes story, and it's actually Robbie Reyes who's playing the supporting character. From some of the issues that I've read of Ghost Rider, like, Gabe has always been the little brother that needs to be taken care of by Robbie, but I was like, why why not we show an issue where he's having a good time? Like, we're celebrating him having a great moment, establishing that, like, yeah, like, he's been seeing this girl in his school. They're already the bestest of friends, and they're a mutual, adorable couple. Robbie is, you know, all for it. He's just there to continue to make Gabe, like, the happiest little brother. Yeah, take him on their plan for the most epic...
I believe it is the ultimate multi-Valentine's Day date.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, I just took notes. So it's I'm cheating. So you're not doing anything wrong. I just have a short list right in front of me. As somebody with an invisible disability who, I mean, you know, I'm very lucky that all of my health stuff stays pretty up and on the clear. But I know that's not the case for a lot of people. And for a lot of people who do have, you know, disabilities or invisible disabilities, the idea that somebody took the time to create the interiority and complex condition of living with a condition and yet still wanting to have the normalcy of experience that is, you know, defined by coming of age. So we're talking about a story that not only seeks to elevate a young minority character from a non-traditional home, but we're talking about a character who presents a visible disability being given the opportunity to thrive in a coming of age setting that's usually reserved for characters that are of more conventional physicalities. And so it's just so many ways, a really groundbreaking story for Marvel, who normally wouldn't push something as unique and one of a kind for something that could be considered so small as an Infinity comic, but by pushing it, it makes it big. And it's a really important story, all things considered.
Thank you. Yeah, you've actually like nailed the whole point. I hope I get to tell more of Gabe and Charlene with Robbie on the side. That's what's great about the Infinity comics. For some of the pitches that I've given to the editors, they've really embraced these ideas, which is just awesome, because these are ideas that might not work in print, but you know, when it's digitally and for subscribers that are already paying annually, like, they got something bonus, and it's a great, nice bonus of something that, you know, the people that only read print are missing out on.
When you look at the X-Men Unlimited run especially, and what you're doing with Madrox, that's almost an example where, yeah, it's bonus material, but like, Madrox is a really important character to a lot of people. I was a huge 90s X-Factor guy. I love the start of X-Factor Investigations. I love Madrox, and I really enjoyed X-Corp, but Jamie was kind of a secondary character there. So there have been a lot of characters that have come out of the Unlimited stories that have been characters that I've really wanted to see, and it's like, it's almost not a bonus for me. It's like, I need this extra outlet because I understand that there's so much going on right now. Not everybody can get their own book or even their own arc, but to have this outlet where we're getting so many great writers and artists to come on and tell unique stories about characters that aren't necessarily going to get main billing, but for those of us who are really diehard X fans, these are characters that we really want to see. And, you know, Strong Guy and Madrox doing kind of a buddy adventure, that's, check that off of a long list of stories that I really want to see in the Krakoan Age, and I'm so happy that we've had it.
Working on a Madrox and Strong Guy three-part story, that's a dream project of mine, to get to write, draw, color a multi-issue arc, kind of like prove to Marvel like I can do this. It was actually just awesome that editor Lauren Emeroshi gave me this opportunity to do this. Just feel very fulfilled by it, to really dig deep into reconnecting these two characters that have been through a lot separately in the past few years, especially with Strong Guy, who in the later issues of X-Factor Investigations, like, he came off as a very bitter, angry dude who lived in hell. To try to bring it back and have Madrox bring him down to the level of being that likable, wisecracking, big guy friend, that was the entire goal of this big monster adventure trilogy.
To set up the friendship between Guido and Jamie to be so iconic to both of those characters in a way that I hadn't realized before, that kind of puts them up in the pantheon of best friends like Kurt and Logan, or, you know, Jean and Aurora.
Yeah.
They're making each other better and bringing themselves back to normal after traumatic experiences.
It's just bringing back, like, why we loved him. Just trying to celebrate their friendship.
And I love the point Jamie made about his dupes being part of him and who he is. And that Guido, you know, being upset that he's not Jamie Prime shouldn't be, because they're all part of Jamie Prime. That was a really good conceptualization of the power that I haven't seen in a while.
Yeah, and the fact that, like, they're creating this memory stranded in the ocean, and he's, like, the only best friend that he's got right now, or at that time, at that moment. They're gonna survive this together as friends. Like, Strong Guy, like, dupe or not, Strong Guy's got to protect him and make sure he survives, so those memories will be preserved. They won't have to have that talk again. That friendship, which started out with a lot of tension, like, reignited when he got stranded. It was like Strong Guy had to protect an external hard drive in a form of a Madrox dupe.
Oh, that's perfect. Love it.
And there's a complexity to the interiority of the way Madrox sort of, like, so the inherent concept of Madrox is there is no one that Madrox would rather be with than himself, but there is no one he would rather run away from faster. But he's managed to understand sort of like a personal social homeostasis with himself that we see reflected in his true understanding that the idea of Madrox Prime is more an idea of making things simple for people who need it simplified. But really, all Madrox, all Madri, as they were, I guess, are the same thing. I'm from the town that Hydrox cookies are from, so as long as you don't call him Madrorio, I'm pretty okay with it. So I think that the idea that Madrox is sort of trapped in isolation with someone who should be the escape from that loneliness, but instead is creating a compound sense of isolation. He doesn't really want to deal with the things Guido wants to deal with. And Guido's being, you know, like, kind of precious about it all. And there's nothing wrong with being precious, but there's also nothing wrong with the expression of Madrox's personal evolution. And I thought that one of the things that you managed to do so beautifully in what amounted to like an annual's worth of content was make up for the time dilation that exists within the microcosmic existence these characters suffer from. You know, it'll be 9 months between appearances from Madrox, and it's 9 months if you're lucky between appearances from Strong Guy. So this idea that you were able to say, all right, this is where we left them, this is where they need to be, we need to bridge this gap for these characters for development, is, you know, not just from a fan point, but from an editorial point, necessary so that these characters don't become relics of a zeitgeist that no longer fits the current paradigm of the X-Men.
Exactly. Wow, you said it, man. Oh, wow.
I don't mean to ask and answer my own questions. I'm so sorry. I just really liked this three-parter a lot.
That was a great observation, really. Yeah, I don't want to even echo that. I mean, that definitely gets a like and a retweet from me.
I mean, it's just been so great. So I'm really grateful. Thank you.
Taking into the more nuts and bolts stuff, what's the experience like of doing all of the heavy lifting and then on an Infinity comic?
It was a lot. It was a huge challenge. And I only said yes because I was like, this is my opportunity to show Marvel like the things I would like to do with Strong Guy and Multiple Man. I just said yes, I will do the 5 issues of X-Men Unlimited. And I didn't even have any pitches when they allotted me those 5 issues. Like, I had a very busy winter working on comics back to back to back to back. Writing, penciling, inking, coloring. On top of working on another creator-owned series that I'm working on with Chip Zdarsky called The All-Nighter. And on top of a 9-to-5 day job. It was just so hard to say no to this opportunity. I just accepted it because I was like, I'm getting what I wanted. Like, Marvel's letting me do what I want with these characters. And there was really no pushback with my story ideas, that this is incentive enough to help me keep going. Like, after working on the 3-part Madrox and Guido story, like, I told Lawrence, like, I might need a break with the 4th issue. I'll write it, but could we find another artist and colorist to work on it so I can kind of catch my breath while working on the All-Nighter with Chip? It was a lot of work, guys. I tweeted just today, I'm at like the tail end of finishing up my comic to-do list that started since September. I did a tally of the number of pages I worked on. I wrote about 68 pages which broke down to like 8 comics, Infinity Comics, short comics. I've drawn, penciled and inked 157 pages, which broke down to 11 comics.
What in the fuck?
Oh. And I colored 53 pages, which was 6 comics, which could have been overlapping with those 11 comics. That was my most productive winter, and I'm just coming down the stretch, like close to the finish line. I just have like one cover left to do of the last issue of All Nighter for Volume 2, and then I'm like, I'm gonna have a summer break right after this. I'm just gonna enjoy life and just read, like catch up on things I've missed out on. I still haven't even finished Moon Knight, guys. There's a lot of things to catch up on, and it's funny, like a lot of my friends who saw that tally, they were like, Jason, you're like a machine. And I'm like, yeah, I am a machine right now. Like, I feel like this automatic person that's just getting by.
I edit like 6 hours of podcast a week. Like, that's the output. That's not the input. I edit like six. I feel it. I sometimes just feel like a DAW. I just feel like a digital audio workstation some days. I'm like, the worst part is when I walk away from my studio and like I hear someone say, and I like reach up to edit it out.
Oh, geez.
And like, I'm just like, fix it. Oh, shit. I'm a person right now. Okay. Right. Turn off robot. Turn off robot. Turn off robot.
Exactly. You know, I'm only one man, but like, there's like lots of multiple man dupes inside my brain that are carrying on different tasks while I'm like sitting at the dinner table or whatever. But now like I can fully go, you know, everything's done. I am more present now.
I think what you do is really impressive. My husband is a colorist. I also make comics. Get into that place where you are so tunnel visioned on the project, and like not in a gross way, but you know, there's times where like you kind of like forget to do things like eat, bathe, like you just become part of the work. And it's so fascinating to be able to like look at a time of your life and be like that output. And like it must be, because I know for me, like when I'm waiting for stuff to be printed, it's so different from being able to like immediately see a reaction. Has that transformed your process at all, that you've gone from like, you know, making comics to like, hey, you're putting it up on marvel.com and it's an unlimited comic, what the fuck?
Once I've done a comic and then like just wait a month or two and then it'll be suddenly out, and to see that rapid response on social media, it's way better than working on print comics for sure. Going back to like self-care, like I definitely made sure that I would get like 7 hours of sleep. I made time to eat lunch and dinner, even, you know, set time to do the errands and give myself weekends off so I can just relax and catch up on other stuff.
Jason Lowe, Canadian superhero.
That was the bare minimum. I don't know if this is something I would condone or encourage other people to do. In a way, it's almost like you really got to have a lot of discipline in yourself to carry through. And I think I conditioned myself to this point ever since I've been working on my independent comic series. I was working on a Toronto offbeat superhero series called The Pitiful Human Lizard, which has like the same kind of humor that you would see in the X-Men comics and the other Marvel stuff. I would do these challenges to myself to see if I can reach very tight deadlines. If I had a day off, I would try to do like 5 to 8 pages a day, like whether it's penciling or inking or even coloring. I would even like kind of brag about like, first I would take a photo of like the first page that I did, and then, you know, 13 days later, all those 24 pages have been inked, and I would lay it out on the floor and I would just take a selfie with them. Before my Instagram got hacked, like people can see like the timestamp of like how fast I was with working on a single issue. Through all those times I wrote, drew, and colored. I had a color assistant for the later issues of Pitiful Human Lizard, but for about 5-6 years I conditioned myself knowing how to manage my time and making comics while working a full-time job to prepare for that moment that, hey, if Marvel does give me that opportunity to do something like this, I'll be ready. I sure showed them. Man, I don't think I would practice doing that amount again. Maybe half the amount next year.
Your output was amazing, so thank you for putting yourself through that. Sorry that you had to.
Well, you know, it was the winter. Like, I figured I would just be hibernating anyways, right?
I've been to Toronto in the winter. it is not something you want to like go outside much.
Especially like during storms. Actually, like it can be as bad as New York City at times.
As somebody who lives 20 minutes from New York City, I really get that vibe 1000%. And we've been real Katie Couric about all of this, you know, but it's time to go real Barbara Walters style here and get real hardball with these questions.
Okay.
So what character are you most eager to be able to interact with from either the X-Men universe or the Marvel universe?
I want to do as many Multiman and Strong Guy stories as possible. I want to be like one of the creators that when people think of Spider-Man, they can think of like their top five favorite creators, like Dan Slott, John Romita Jr. or John Romita Sr., Stan Lee and Steve Ditko. But, you know, Jamie Madrox, like I want to build myself up to that echelon eventually.
Okay, so going off of that, who do you want to put Madrox on a team with? What's your Madrox book?
Because this is a Krakoa age, I mean, like, Madrox has to fulfill his obligations at X-Corp, or at least his dupes will fulfill that obligation. He's just going to focus on his family life, and I think there'd be a lot of great, wacky family story adventures with him and Layla Miller, Davey, and Strong Guy. It will kind of have that, like, 90s family sitcom vibe, but, you know, imagine if, like, each family member fought crime, and they're still in a universe filled with cosmic beings and heroes and villains. That's a story that I want to tell.
I love it. I love the idea of the Madrox family, like, almost having a silly 90s sitcom vibe to it.
It'll be like Multiplicity with Michael Keaton, with a Brad Garrett type of best friend, you know, in the form of Strong
Raymond
Guy. Exactly. So I'm a big pro wrestling fan. When I was trying to get his cadence, the right diction for Strong Guy, I was channeling AEW wrestler Eddie Kingston.
Oh my god. Yes.
Yes.
Oh, perfect. Like,
it got too strong where like the higher ups, they want you to tone it down a little bit, because like he kind of lost a bit of that accent. Like it's a bit toned down these days. Like, all right, I'll tone it down, but I'll throw some of that, you know, partner here and there.
That is like, that's exactly who I was thinking of when I was reading this. I was like, oh, it's a little bit like Eddie Kingston, who I think half the time is a little bit like Ben J. Grimm.
I also just want to thank you for having one of the hottest Strong Guys in a really long time. There's like a real delicate balance to like hyper muscle where it can get kind of like, you know, icky, making it real tasteful and sexy. And so I just want to thank you for putting Guido on the handsomer side of real tasteful and sexy, because he can look real fucking rough.
I definitely am not known as the artist that draws everything like hyper masculine. More down-to-earth figures. I hope you definitely enjoyed like the third part where I was like, when it comes to coloring, like I should definitely add some like glistening highlights off their skin. Like that really makes it pop out a bit more. They've been sweating out on Monster Island. Like that skin's gonna shine.
They're gonna glow. They're gonna have that friends with crazy mutant shark tadpoles living it up on Monster Island, fighting Lord Zemnu, super gorgeous shine. Oh. Glow that you can only get from being trapped in the ocean.
Okay, exactly. And that was so much more perfect than that weird purple suntan they gave Dazzler in the Outback. So, like, yes, thank you. Awesome.
Oh, my pleasure.
We love when people understand the core identity of the character. That's like the X's for podcast litmus test. Do whatever, because retcons are fine, but do you understand the core identity of the character in this story? And I feel like something that we have found across your work has been a resounding yes. And as like canonistas, you know, we care. So we're really, as a team, you know, big fans.
Really just curious if there's anything else coming up for you that we should look out for on Marvel Unlimited or on any other venue.
I did say that I was assigned to work on 5 X-Men Unlimited issues. So far, you've seen 4. So one more is coming out later this summer. It's already done, and I can't say who's in it, but people are going to have a huge blast out of it. And Lauren was like, yeah, she even said like this was like the funnest issue she's ever seen of X-Men Unlimited. I had lots of fun working on it, too. Outside of Marvel Unlimited, outside of Marvel, to check out my series that I'm working on with Chip Zdarsky, The all-nighter. The second volume just came out. It just launched with issue number 6 out on Comixology. Once all the 5 issues have been digitally available, they'll be collected into a trade paperback published through Dark Horse Comics. All-Nighter is about a family of vampires that run a late-night diner. A couple of them decide to become superheroes and use their vampirism to fight crime.
That sounds so incredibly up my alley. I cannot wait to read it.
We did a lot of fun takes with everyone's favorite classic monsters. And I think you're going to appreciate some of these pretty sexy takes of these monsters.
Hell yeah.
Now that Guido is Eddie Kingston's got me thinking, who would Madrock be a little bit more of?
The funny thing is, now that the 3-part issue is finally out, people have already seen it. I think some people can find some similarities to Madrox. You know, I used to cosplay as Madrox for like a few years.
I did in fact see that in my research for you. I was like, you know what? Because a lot of times you don't realize that fan art exists by an artist. So let me just type in Jason Lowe into Google. And there he is in a Madrox shirt. Same shirt. I have it. Same bro. We're Madrox dupes together. I love it.
Nice. Have you seen the ones where I'm with my dupes?
Yes. I stalked way, because that makes me sound creepy. But like, I do my due diligence. I don't want somebody coming on this show being like, I don't know how you didn't know this obscure thing. And me be like, I'm sorry.
I did take a break making comics just to refocus myself. And I was like, you know, I'm just going to just cosplay as multiple man. I actually joined an X-Men cosplay charity group where we did lots of fundraising and clothing drives for local shelters and food banks, all for a great cause. We organized events like Cosplay Skate at the Nathan Phillips Square rink. There's a lot of fun memories with like hanging out with my friends as we dressed up as our favorite X-Men characters and just doing a lot of good around the city. It became full circle that I had the opportunity to write and draw a Multiple Man story, sneakingly draw him in a way where if people see that and look at my profile picture, it's on a nose. And I got away with it. Sorry.
No, yeah, get away with it. It's your time.
Yes.
Like, when else are you going to get away with it except when you get away with it? Yeah. Like, I own your fucking space, man. Every lane is your lane if you drive right. So I want to thank you so much for making time from what sounds like a hellaciously busy schedule to stop by our humble cloud-based studio, because really, we have enjoyed celebrating your work in this last few months, and we look forward to the secret 5th story.
So excited.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, as well as checking out your other work. Super excited. And thank you again for making the time to come out. It's always a pleasure getting to interview the people who make the stories we love.
Oh, my pleasure, guys. It's, you know, like coming off the tail end of like working off on so many comic projects and it's all winding down. Like, it's awesome to like just take a moment, catch my breath and talk to people that read my work and appreciate it. And it feels really good that like all that hard work paid off. Thank you for letting me hang out with you guys.
Well, do me a favor, plug yourself real hard so everybody knows where they can find you online so they can check out more of your amazing content.
So people can find me on Twitter at rebel_LOO, and you can find me on Instagram and TikTok at JasonLOOMakesComics.
Hey everybody, so Nico here one more time, and Asgardian Wars has always been a favorite of ours, and there's still so many great ideas here, but this examination really helped us to see how far comics have come, especially the X-Men line, when it comes to properly representing characters, diversity, and so much more. But parts of this story will always live on in our hearts as something so special to so many of us. You can check out the second part of our coverage focusing on the New Mutants and X-Men parts, while this episode focuses primarily on X-Men Alpha Flight, next week on Friday. Don't forget, you guys can check out this show 3 times a week, currently running around the MC2 universe with a complete look at Marvel 982, MC2 Mondays. You can check us out Wednesdays, covering all sorts of new comics on Modern Marvels, and then here on XI4P Premiere Fridays, where we talk to creators, have a great time looking at major events, and chronoskim some classic books that deserve another look. Until next time, guys, enjoy this last segment. Keep those mutant lights lit, those Krakoan gateways open. Remember, I've been Nico Action. You guys can find me on Twitter and Instagram at NicoAction, and we'll see ya.
Hey, everybody, welcome to the Back Thou Unto Dost, the AXS for podcast. You know, it's really, I don't know how Loki does it, dude. It's really intense.
There are rules. So there are actual rules to those.
I doubt very much that some of the writers at Marvel were, number one, aware of the rules.
Oh, and yeah, those they have no idea.
I'm not sure they were super hardcore about it. That does make this X's for Podcast, Chronoskimming Classics, where we take a look at the stories that built the incredible X universe we play in today. I'm Nico, and you guys can find me chronoskimming through Twitter and Instagram at NicoAction. That's N-I-C-O-A-C-T. I-O-N.
Hey, everybody, it's Nathan. You can find me online at Dazzler AOA, where you can find me turning into the Enterprise and flying around in a little slave collar in Asgard.
I'm Tori. You can find me on Twitter at Tori_Sheehan and on Instagram at SMTori. That's Tori with an I. Honestly, I'm just here for the ride.
And I'm TK. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at XNateXGrayX, dressing and looking exactly like my mom and somehow completely deceiving my dad about the fact that I'm his child.
That means we are here to talk about the one, the only. I mean, when you think about stories where the writer went in and said, I'm going to craft a narrative that will have a very specific first page and a very specific last page, and it's one unstoppable, flowing idea. Of course, we all think about Asgardian Wars. And by that, I mean to highlight the irony of the fact that this trade exists by concept only. We're going to be taking a look at X-Men Alpha Flight numbers 1 and 2, as well as New Mutants Special Edition and Uncanny X-Men Annual Number 9. So this spans a lot of characters, a lot of ideas. We're going from Alpha Flight to Asgard. Okay, so it doesn't span that many letters, but I would love to start off with, who here loves Alpha Flight in concept? I know I do.
I love Alpha Flight in concept, and I love some of the actual execution of Alpha Flight, too, even. I think I have pretty much every issue of the original Alpha Flight run.
I like their diversity.
I live very close to French Canada, and there are a lot of French Canadians shuttling back and forth between my area and their homeland.
I will also say it was very strange for me to see all of the French words coming out of neither Rogue nor Gambit's mouth. So,
you know, okay, so Alpha Flight is one of those teams that is super problematic in a lot of regards. You know, it's a bunch of people who didn't really understand a culture, writing about a culture that sounded really cool because of those National Geographics where you got to look at those savages living in their wilderness. You know what I mean? So it is born of some deep uncomfortability. And I feel as though in the years since, we've seen a lot defter hands return to Alpha Flight with a certain amount of greater understanding. And it is definitely not a knock against these heroes who we love so much. But, you know, we have definitely had contributors from Canada that are like, hey, Alpha Flight, problematic as fuck. What's up? And so I really do love the idea of Alpha Flight. Now, it's a fucking huge cast, and I don't understand how anybody is meant to keep track of all of them. But for me, when you ask me who's my Alpha Flight member, it is Puck. And why? Because shorties are fucking hot. And Puck is just a wet dream designed for me. He's so hot and hairy. He's like the ultimate pocket gay bear. He is like really sexy. And I love Puck. Who's everybody's favorite Alpha Flighter? Alpha Flight Shin? Alpha Flight Tomos? Yo Tango Alpha Flight?
You know, like the other day on Twitter, I accidentally called them Aloha Flight.
Okay, no, that's my new favorite team.
Yeah. I really want Aloha Flight. How dare you make me only pick one favorite of Alpha Flight? It would probably be Talisman. I love Elizabeth's journey from the start of the series to become an all-powerful girl boss character. And then her journey afterwards, where she really becomes more of a nuanced character who is so strong with her mysticism. My other outside favorite of Alpha Flight is Purple Girl. Love me some Kara Kilgrave. When the Purple Children were showing up in Daredevil, I was like, is Kara part of them? But no, sadly.
Wait,
not really.
What?
Oh, I know, Tori. As he's saying this, my eyes are lighting up and I'm like, this is everything Tori needs to hear.
Okay.
Okay. One of the purple children is on Alpha Flight, and she's like a grown-ass woman.
Yeah. Like... love her. I love her. I loved her, like, villainous turn. I'm so excited to see her in Thunderbolt with fucking Monica Rambeau. So that's probably my second favorite Alpha Flight person.
For me, I'm going to go with the Beaubier twins, who combined make one character's worth of slightly less problematic development and understanding. I can't maintain that much longer, I think, but between their start and now, that's almost one whole character that's not just the absolute worst to deal with.
Tori, did any of the amazing superheroes from the North stand out to you? Was there somebody who was just like them?
I liked that it took me a really long time to realize that the scientists were not the Alpha Flight people, because I was very confused for a very long time. The girls, the redheaded one seemed nice and smart-ish, and the other one seems insane and a monster fucker, so I respect that. And
God damn, I love your reads on these stories coming in as somebody yes. who wants to know more. And you're like, because it's never in judgment. You're never like, fuck this book. You're like, book has some odd fucking to it, and I'm here to do the fuck.
Yeah,
so I'm like, here for it.
I'm here, you know. I'm down to get dirty. I don't understand what their issues are. I understand what Aurora's issue is. She's got that split personality. I understand what North Star's is. He is very closeted. And I understand what Sasquatch's is. He's the beast, but more northern, but like with a little bit of Hulk involved. I don't know.
That is exactly Sasquatch. I love it. That's a perfect read.
The redheaded chick is just a widow to some dude who was apparently great. And then we have a lot of ableism about the puck guy. And is that all of them? The shaman.
Shaman, yeah.
Shaman and Talisman. His amazing
shaman
daughter.
And Talisman. Talisman seems rad. She seems the most like competent out of them all.
She always looks to me like she's Cher halfway through a Bob Mackie change. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, like, mm-hmm. I always think she looks hyper fantastic.
And, like, they hinted that she has issues with her dad, but she shows up when he's upset. So, like, obviously there's history there. I don't know. I feel like I stepped into the middle of something and I was just like, I guess I can see how all this works together, but there's a lot of question marks. So, like, I can't choose a favorite because I don't know these people. Like, right now, my favorite is Madeline Pryor because I don't know anything about her. And there's a child? I didn't know there was a child. Isn't she just Jean again?
Chloe.
Oh, no. Yeah. She is basically Erica Fortune. She is basically Erica Fortune.
Right. I know. I know that she's batshit crazy and a goblin queen and, like, the dark force incarnate or whatever. But, like, she's also Jean Grey, just two steps to the left, right? Like,
you're gonna say Jean Grey side boob. Yes, she is Jean Grey side boob, 1,000%.
I mean, at this point, she's absolutely none of these things, and it's crazy how obvious it is that things take a wild turn.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
What is up with the X-Men? And there's some blonde dude who's Doug, who is also a linguist, a cunning linguist. And
yes!
then there's a warlock who is back. Lovely to see him, I guess.
Oh, self-friend missed you. Oh, yeah. That's so cute. You're like a warlock expert now.
He's a cutie, and I'm understanding more of him, but still understanding less of him. And Cannonball continues to just be a blonde. With an accent? Question
yes.
mark?
Oh, yes.
Thick accent.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then there's
like, specifically, you should feel comfortable calling him a honk.
And then someone is a wolf and wants to fuck another wolf who's not even human. And I think they're both children. And then there's another one who's got blonde curly hair who might be full of fire, but in a different way from the Hispanic one who's full of fire. And then there's the one that was in the first part of Demon Days, maybe?
Yes.
So that's all of those, right? Right? I didn't miss one of them.
Karma.
Is Karma a new mutant?
Yeah.
Yes.
She was the butt of many fat phobic joke in the beginning of it.
No kidding. Yeah. No kidding.
But don't worry. Soon she will be, soon she'll be a queer amputee. And that's somehow much, much better.
With so many of these characters, I'm like, I know where you're going or I know where you were, but there's enough time in between each of those and what's happening right now for me to be like, what's going on?
Dolly Parton. Traveling Through starts playing.
And also the Enchantress just really wants to fuck Ileana.
Yeah.
And everyone else.
And isn't this a child? Why is she dressed like this?
And why is Amora always sitting with, like, pushing her boobs?
These are children, right? I'm not crazy. These are, like, 16.
No, they are children. They are children.
Yeah, okay. Probably younger than 16.
Wolf girl's, like, 14.
That wolf prince is Red Riding her hood. So, like, I don't know what's up with that.
Oh, they have a baby together later.
Is it a baby? Is it a puppy?
Yeah. No, it's a disgusting wolf baby.
Aww. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a horrid little monster, and I forgot that's such a tear is such a big part of this.
Yeah.
Is this Werewolf at Night?
No, I don't want it.
No, this is neither Werewolf by Night, nor is it Man-Wolf.
Man-Wolf is a Jameson.
Yes, yes. Oh, you're doing it.
I love it.
But it was produced by Dick Wolf.
Chong Chong. It all films on Chelsea Piers.
And Vagina Wolf.
I like Vagina Wolf better than Dick Wolf.
Who's afraid of Vagina Wolf?
Right? That's an amazing name, Vagina Wolf, Virginia Wolf.
So now we do have one more set of characters to discuss. I can't.
Oh yeah, Loki's here too, and like Storm is now his like bartered bride that he's gonna. She doesn't have powers anymore. When did she lose her powers? Is it because there was a mohawk?
No, because of Forge. He took her powers because with a gun. Mystique and Destiny sent her on a journey to go save Rogue.
And the gun has recently returned in the present day.
Yep.
Also, I'm a big Rogue fan, but whatever this look is not doing it for me, and no matter what is happening, it's not doing it for me.
This is her pre-Australian sexual awakening. She's also pretty young here. Give her a minute.
Yeah.
And Kitty got her first perm.
Tori, you have so many feels about this issue. I am like, I am so here.
And also, like, are we horse fuckers? Is that what we're trying to say the Valkyries are? Because, like, they are, oh, God.
Well, so I also need to point out, for those of you at home who are playing along and are unaware, I'm pretty sure Tori's favorite Marvel character is Loki.
It is.
But not this Loki.
This has got a lot of my faves in it, and all of them are making me sad.
Oh. It's like your favorite pie, but all the ingredients are just slightly spoiled, so every bite you're like, no.
It's like you're like, I want this delicious burger, the juiciest, best burger you've ever had in your life, and then someone says, we're putting a scoop of your favorite caramel chocolate swirl ice cream on top of it, and then we're including your favorite sushi roll on top too, and just enjoy.
I would eat
and yet
that.
No Erica Kane. I meant Erica Fortune. I said Erica Kane. I gotta go. You know what? If Susan Lucci wants to be in this fucking book. Okay.
We have not discussed a single panel yet. I want to throw that out there. We are solid 15 minutes into this.
Okay, wait. Can we talk about why does Rachel Summers go to the Danger Room in aerobic outfits?
Everybody's in aerobics outfits.
They're working out. They're working out their issues and their muscles.
I also like to think that when she showed up in our timeline, the first thing she saw was the physical video by Olivia Newton-John and was just like, I'll go with it.
Or it's that episode of The Golden Girls where the Golden Girls who get their fitness stuff, and it's Diva Tox from Power Rangers that sells them their fitness stuff. Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God, the workout. That's exactly what Rachel Summers wears at the time. Dorothy and Blanche's workout outfit they bought. Yeah.
Yep. Anybody who's, you know, really serious about getting in shape wouldn't even touch him. So,
also, why is Rachel afraid of telling Scott the truth?
Oh, my God, because Rachel is nothing but a Jean stand-in for so long that the idea of developing her character is so scary that she has to be afraid of it at all times so she doesn't do it.
But the in-universe reason is that she's trying not to affect the timeline, but that basically gets shit-canned in this specific story when she finds out that the baby is not her. Although why she thought the baby was her when the baby's mother is different than her is just utter malarkey and nonsense.
That's the weirdest Maury, you're not the mother scene I've ever seen. You are not the daughter.
She should have come back and been like, where's my mom? She's not here. I guess the future's not happening. Like,
she did.
So then why does she think it's, oh, you know what? I'm out.
All right. Well, then I'm going to, you know, it's getting to that time where we should talk about the books. So we're definitely here to talk about X-Men Alpha Flight Parts 1 and 2, which are by the incredible creative team of Chris Claremont writing, with Paul Smith and Bob Wiakek on art, Tom Orzechowski on letters, with Glynis Oliver on colors. It is of note that this is based on a premise by Jim Shooter and Nascenti and Denny O'Neill. One of the things that I find really fascinating about this story is historically contextualizing it with a little bit of time coding. Now, when this book came out, it was released in September of 1985. What's significant about that is where it's slotted in canon, per the editor's note early on in the book, is roughly 8 issues earlier, putting it solidly in the John Byrne run. However, Chris Claremont was not meant to write Alpha Flight during John Byrne's tenure. This book comes out the same month John Byrne leaves Alpha Flight after his enormous blowout with Chris Claremont that ultimately led to the dissolution of one of the greatest teams in comic book history. We're talking peak bad blood Katie Taylor shit here.
this is some like Joan Crawford, Betty Davis shit.
The Simon and Garfunkel.
This is when Miley wasn't allowed to sit with Demi and Selena at that table at that kids awards show, and everybody knew that that's what was going on. So this book in some ways reads like 2% like a fuck you to John Byrne. You know, Chris Claremont always felt that he had been equally an influence on Alpha Flight. And I get it. I very get it. You know, it's something I was talking about with TK recently, where I said that one of the hardest things to do is put a enormous writer with a really powerful editor, because that's two enormous egos behind the scenes. And I think that good egos, it takes an ego to create something really like, what the fuck is happening? And, you know, be proud, be confident. It can be the same thing of an artist and a writer, for sure. And I think this book in some ways reads very disconnected from everything going on around it. You know, I love this title, but how do you guys feel about where it goes in the greater scope of Marvel canon?
I mean, I think one thing I want to say, just slightly separate from that, but important to keep in mind just in terms of historical context, is there is a bunch of really racist and ableist language in this book that
yes, there is.
Absolutely not be acceptable today. And yet, as I was thinking about it, there were at least two phrases that I thought would accidentally make it through editorial, unfortunately. We would just have a very different reaction to that happening. I just want to warn any readers who are potentially triggered by ableist language or racist language, it's definitely in there. I do like to believe that in general, editorial would do better lately, but this is a part of the history of the book. People like Claremont, who believed they had the best of intentions, still wrote some really hellacious shit from time to time, and yeah, you can always do better.
Not only that, but the other arc has a lot of fat phobia as well, so there's yeah.
So thanks for coming along, Tori.
I mean, you gotta drag me into some not good ones eventually.
And I don't think anything about X-Men Alpha Flight is not good, but when I think about the idea of a slotted bottle episode, like, and I feel silly calling it like a slotted bottle episode, but this really does explain why Chris Claremont so frequently throughout the last 30 years since his original run ended has seen ways to just go back in and pop in a story you didn't know. Because this came out like 8 months after it's supposedly meant to go. And when I sort of think about that balance, when I think about those numbers and that kind of placement, I think that there's a real sense of this is a complete story unto itself.
It is. And it's a really good one. If you are a current X-Men reader that has been curious about the pasts of a lot of characters and some of the characterization that you might hear about on shows like ours, where we talk about things like Rachel's tortured past and how she's always upset about her parents, there are a lot of X-Men issues that you can read to see that, to the point where it's kind of overwhelming. You could pick up a book like this and get a really great idea of a lot of stuff that was going on in the 80s. For instance, the absence of Storm's powers, the stuff that's going on with Rachel, her relationship with Kitty. There's a lot of this is somebody's first issue, it has to explain everything, but it's not a lot of issues. So if you can get through these four, you'll know actually quite a lot about the status quo of 80s X-Men and New Mutants in a way that's really fun and like even kind of you can see reflections of today in a lot of ways.
this.
I will say, it's not like the exposition fairy comes around so much. They actually do a very good job of showing, not telling throughout a lot of this. And it's extreme versions of conversations and interactions, but it is very interesting to read and be swept in by.
I think with this arc, it's probably the best arc to look back at what was great and what was really problematic about those years. So there's so much great interplay, but you've got to look at it from a modern set of eyes where you're like, whoa, a lot of this language, a lot of these jokes do not fly. As a kid, I love this so much, but like now looking back at it, I'm like, wow, there's a lot of stuff in this run to be not so proud of.
And it's still a thing I think worth doing. I'm not saying that we need to necessarily go in and update every book, but it is worth it having a sensitivity editor run through titles every now and then and find ways to correct language. Perhaps, you know, drop, oh man, you're so fat, and, you know, find another way to reference the distress that the character is going through. I think there is a lot to be said for the ability to update these stories and that to sort of heal the situation. The strength of the stories lies in the storytelling narrative. The power of Chris Claremont to craft together a sort of horror experience. You know, you don't think of this as a horror book, but that uncertain plane opening, yeah, that's really pretty taut. This book doesn't suffer for being like 50 pages an issue. Maybe New Mutants Special Edition goes on a little longer than I needed it to, but these two issues, X-Men Alpha Flight, despite being like 100 pages, between two fucking issues, It really feels like page economy was thought out at a smart meter.
Definitely agree. X-Men Alpha Flight reads really, really quick. So does the X-Men Annual. Yeah, the New Mutant Special Edition reads a little long. I think it was setting up a lot of exposition that maybe was unnecessary.
I think for me, it even though the pages were long, I felt like each character kind of gets their time to shine in a really nice way. And especially for someone who's coming in and is like, I don't know any of these people, it was good for me to be able to latch on to each of them specifically and singularly for several pages at a time.
And I think possibly the strength of it is also the weakness of it insofar as there are so many characters that using a lot of pages to deal with all of them is important, but there are actually too many even for the amount of pages that we have. The cast of scientist humans that are being transported that then get transformed into magical post-Asgardian human people fleshes things out beyond a point where you can sort of, I think, reasonably hold in your head. The X-Men, Alpha Flight, you've got Scott and Madeline that are kind of straddling all the worlds, and then all these other people, it does get to be a bit much, but also in a way where like it's so much that you're distracted from the fact that this is going quite long.
And I think something that Claremont is an expert at is designing an entry point into a story where it feels a little in media res, it feels a little bit like you're jumping in on something. The plane sequence giving way to the danger room sequence, giving way to Rachel's sort of nightmare sequence, is a hallmark of classic annual style Claremont storytelling. When he has the room to decompress an idea really fully, it's something he enjoys doing, and it also allows him that sort of interactive, hey, this is who my characters are. It also gave him the opportunity to balance this great number of characters. It does get a little bit difficult to keep everybody clear throughout these sort of vignettes setting up the story if you're perhaps not an existing reader, but I think Claremont does it with a deftness such that by the time Rachel has her vision and the X-Men begin to interact with it, worried about Scott, I'm pretty engaged, even though this feels in some ways like a low-stakes annual.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, while my complaint is the scientist, Claremont does a good job of making them both functional story points and not characters that you're so worried about remembering who's who that it becomes problematic. It's just a lot of faces to look at, and man, the art really is gorgeous, so you do want to look at them.
I think you almost have to be an Alpha Flight fan to really kind of like get the full benefit of this, because X-Men fans at the times probably didn't get enough of the characterization of Alpha Flight to really get to know the characters. Everybody falls in line, I think. It was only consequential of a story to Alpha Flight Light, because that's the only time that it was ever really followed up on around issue 50, when they sent Northstar off to Asgard because that was going to cure his mysterious illness.
I'm just remembering that I'm watching Charles stand up this whole time, so sorry. I like skipped forward a few pages okay. and was like, he's standing? I don't understand.
But when Huck said that one line about Charles, like, he wouldn't understand what it was like, this is so icky.
And I think one of the things that makes this story move pretty quickly is the jump from scene to scene with all of the characters. Mm-hmm. I think that having the constant fight sequences between characters in these sort of miniseries is a standard element of painting together this picture, and it definitely gives you a sense of everybody's power level. If you're coming because you're an X-Men person, gauging the Alpha Flight team by the X-Men allows you to understand their power levels and how they operate. It's one of the things that I think is important when you're trying to write a crossover like this. Claremont did have a strong understanding of who Alpha Flight were at the time that he wrote them. So I think the fight sequences do play out pretty balanced. I don't know how you guys feel, but for me, this still had pretty good fight pacing by today's stance.
Oh gosh, agree. The fights were quick, they were big, they were epic, there were some nice side action. I love the pacing of it.
I did get that whenever I read the X-Men, that like within the first few pages, you definitely have to have a danger room fight. You have to have like some misconceived fight between people who are going to be teammates half a page later. Like there was a lot of those basic standby beats, but they were beautiful to look at and really utilize some art in a way that I haven't seen from some older issues. So it was really, really beautiful to look at.
And I also love that you get moments like Rogue pairing up with Northstar to do reconnaissance, you know, not just moments in which characters are using their powers for fighting and we're seeing who's matched with whom, but who complements each other and who would go off together. And the Rogue Northstar one is a really great pairing early on in this issue, because we do get that follow-up that we joked about earlier, where Rogue is clearly feeling a couple of things for Northstar, who clearly has no interest in this woman.
That part was like, rereading it now, that part is the most confusing to me, because she clearly knows that he's queer. Like, that's like almost mm-hmm. subsexually mentioned, but like, she still has a like little, like, I don't know, like gay BFF crush on her, or like, I don't get that part of Rogue's arc.
I really like to think that Rogue comes into her own sexually in the moment in the Australian outback where she looks at Colossus's body and is like, I cannot contain myself. And Rogue from that point on becomes a lot more sexually self-aware. And before that, Rogue is exactly the type of person who, due to the not great parenting of her moms from time to time and the difficulty of her powers, would literally be the type of person to have the knowledge from somebody else's mind that they are not interested in her for purely like physical reasons that don't have anything to do with something that's wrong with her, and still be like, oh, I want him though. Like, I'm going to give it a shot and see what happens.
That makes sense though. That makes sense. Maybe not that she wants him to want her, but she knows that she can be safe to interact with him because he's not going to want to touch her. And that's her biggest fear. Oh my gosh. Okay. This whole thing makes sense, a little bit more sense now.
And I think there's definitely an element to the level of confusion and self-denial that he experiences. She doesn't just take on his truth. She takes on his memories. So she takes on the memories of 20 something years of self-denial and rejection of self-identity, not just the awareness that he's queer. So it's a lot of layers to the way she interacts with Northstar in this story. And it is definitely a standout moment in his history for many, many years for many, many authors. So, does somebody have something?
No, I would say besides the early bit with Raymond, his mentor / supposed lover, like, I think this is the most implicit, like, Northstar is queer bit that they were allowed to put in.
All right, so let's get to the thing that, you know, is the tough thing. Madeline Pryor, at this point in canon, only has powers in this story simply because it's a sort of minor in this little magic universe story, and she was never meant to have powers again. You know, ultimately, the story would be driven somewhere very differently than Chris Claremont was imagining at this time. But as Anodyne, Madeline Pryor is the, like, representative representation of all that is good and healing and looks kind of like an Eternal designed out of extra microwave parts.
Yep. She is very much the Madonna. She heals. She grows life. She is kind. She is sweet. She is all of these things. And I'm just like, oh, that's nice and boring.
I love how this sets up a lot of continuity issues with this X-Men Alpha Flight arc. Obviously, as a mutant, her as a clone of a mutant who is a mutant herself. I don't know how that works. Like, she would have had different abilities. I don't know if this was a sinister design that was sort of like meant to distract people from the fact that she's Jean Grey, or if this was just I don't know how you could reconcile this part of Maddie Pryor's.
Wait. She's not supposed to have powers.
She is right not. Now? She, at this time, she was just assumed to be a human and
who looked exactly like Jean.
And that also was a thing that was kind of an artist interpretation thing more. The fact that they have red hair is really.
I mean, Jean never looks the same from one artist to
precisely.
The next anyway. So,
she was intended to be just. She will be retconned to be a clone. At this time, she was not that. She is just a human woman that married Scott Summers, who is a mutant who also got weird powers here. And you can do the whole, because she's a clone, it's a latent mutation. It doesn't fully manifest until what happens later in Inferno. So there's ways to retcon around it if you really want to. The fact of the matter is, this hasn't been a story that has been so integral to the Maddie mythos that it really even needs to be reckoned with in the first place. And it's funny because I'm the first person that always wants to take any single weird story like this that's in its own little pocket and be like, why is this the most important thing on Krakoa today? And this is one of those ones where I'm like, we could leave it and just have our Goblin Queen back the way that she is and never ask anybody to address that anodyne time.
Like, the only thing it's important for is the fact that she's pregnant.
Yes. Aw, she was so cute when she blushed. So really, they never, there's never a moment where she's like, this dark power moving through me. Oh, the power, how I used to have it as anodyne, and now it is this and something, something, and guilt and whatever. Like, there's so much you could mine there.
Yeah, no, she doesn't never really ever reference this.
This is never followed up in X-Men comics, only in Alpha Flight comics. Even Scott seemingly figuring out that Rachel is his daughter is never mentioned again. Like, when you look at the next arc that we look at with the New Mutant special in the X-Men annual, he's like, why are you dressed as Phoenix? She's like,
Oh, you thought that he figured it out?
I thought he figured it out at the end of X-Men Alpha Flight.
No, he's big and dumb. He doesn't figure that out at all.
He didn't.
No.
Well, and I just need to point out the extra layer that you need here, Tori, is at this point, Madeline Pryor is pregnant with Cable.
Yep.
Oh, I was wondering who this kid is.
And another layer that I just want to fold on top of this that isn't relevant, but I need you to know, is that later her ghost will make out with another clone of Cable.
He's the genetic kid of Scott Summers and Jean Grey.
And she makes out with him.
She does. It's bad. It's really bad.
He has the same genes as her son, and she makes out with him.
It's bad. It's bad.
Multiple times.
But that could be retconned as the alternate universe reality version of Jean Grey.
No, it's not. It's Madeline at that time. It's Jean Grey later. You could fix it if you really needed to, but I want to leave it in because it's the worst and it should stay that way.
It's very awful.
How many X-Men have tried to fuck one of their one degree separation relatives?
We don't have time to list all of them. So we're going to save that for a very special episode that we do later this.
I'm going to tell you something. Dazzler's son is her husband's father.
We've
it's a
all
closed
been
time
there.
Loop. That's one of the more okay ones.
We've all been there. Her son is her husband's father?
All right, I got it. Dazzler is where I draw the line. I'm going to push us back to this book for a minute. I mean, the hard thing here is the story is such a self-contained logical conclusion, and everything that happens is pretty immediately undone. Loki's involvement is one of the hardest things to figure out in this. He's in like 6 pages. Even then, he's not even like the biggest deal in those 6 pages. So I find a lot of the story meant to be about forging a sort of like teammateship between these teams in a way that makes us believe that they're going to have to unite against someone in the end. But I don't really feel like that's where this story goes. I feel like ultimately Loki is defeated by not knowing how his bosses are going to react to his tactics, and it just feels odd.
It's really more of like a mystery than it is a battle to the end and to fight the enemy.
Yeah, because for the most part, one of the big things about this story that I find a pretty key element of the whole thing is all of this is meant to be, for Chris Claremont, I think, a reckoning of where these characters are and how they need to be thinking logically about their progression. You know, one of the things that I think is crazy is that this is back when, you know, Rogue's power. So, okay, Rogue goes through this pretty dramatic transformation from interesting character pushing the limits of mutant logic and mutant powers to Swamp Girl, Gambit's Swamp Girl. And I don't know what to do with that. But this is back when, like, Rogue's got wild powers. And, like, this is really interesting because then we see her try to absorb Loki and she can't. This is a Rogue who can do anything at this point, and she can.
It's also interesting that most people associate Rogue with having a death touch that, like, yes, technically she absorbed powers and memories, but it is so toxic that she should never for any reason do it. And this is a really good reminder that for a long time, yeah, it made you pass out. Maybe it wasn't the best idea. You probably didn't want to do it every day, but she could touch you, take your powers, take your memories, use your powers, and everything would be okay, if not at the end of the issue, at the end of the arc. We then go into the Carol Danvers thing, and from there it's just like she must never be touched for any reason, no matter what. And then we roll into she can touch anything whenever she wants, always.
See, I thought this did a good job of actually identifying how toxic her powers are, because when she absorbs Northstar's memory and she confronts him about his memories, and she's like, and he's like, you had no right, and she's like, I had no choice. But like, he could have not done that. She could have knocked Northstar out with her Carol Danvers powers.
They're definitely socially toxic in terms of like issues of consent and all that, but there comes a point where she literally, it's always said, she can't touch anyone for any reason. Like, this is more contact than she has with Gambit the entire time they have their romance until they're married.
I was also a little weirded out when she decided that to touch him is to make out with him.
Oh, then don't ever read any Rogue from now until 96, 97.
I like her so much, but like, woof, what a choice.
She loves to forcibly kiss someone to make the statement that she will be taking your powers now.
Her writers love to make her forcibly kiss someone to take their powers.
Yeah, it's real rough.
Yeah.
And it's because there isn't enough thought put into the ways that sexuality can be explored in logical ways. It's such a very on-the-nose sort of idea. And yeah, you know, I'm not saying it's quite as basic as the character named Forearm has Forearm. God, I would hate to meet Foreskin. But it would
Wait,
be...
Wait, would you hate or really, love to meet Foreskin?
I really don't think I would. Four sets of skin? That's just like skin, but worse.
There are chimeras in this world who have 4 kinds of skin, and you figure it out.
Find a way to make it work.
Yeah.
You're right. You find a way to make it work. You make a tradition out of it. You celebrate the day of Koa. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. So now the key element here, the linchpin in all of this, is Madeline's role. So I don't mean to minimize the Rachel story, but it's sort of like Rachel's so whiny and Madeline's so brave. Madeline's like, all right, Loki, I'll play your game. And he's like, will you? And she's like, yes. And he's like, nah. And she's like, oh my God, stop. And he's like, fine. Most people don't give in like that. And she's like, and then like, she's saved because some elder gods are like, that's not how we want this to go. But meanwhile, Rachel's like, I'm the baby, me, I'm baby, not a boy, me. And that sort of stark contrast of these two women that are both stand-ins for Jean is a really fascinating contextualization of this two-part miniseries. You know, Cyclops is the catalyst for this. Wolverine is the access point to Alpha Flight. And then it's all about two Jean stand-ins facing off against Loki, who is, for all intents and purposes, a classic Magneto stand-in. Tori, you might not ever believe this, but there was a period period in time where Magneto was like, number one, I'm a telepath. So, and I'm a telepath on the par with Charles Xavier, plus the magnetic powers. Plus, I'm like a super technological genius and I can build machines that mess with people's genetics all the time. Land. And I'm going to build super intelligent AI robots and I'm going to build super bombs. And so there was a period in time where Magneto was just like Purple Doctor Doom. And this really is sort of a classic X-Men story with classic Magneto, but instead we're slotting in Loki, who is a Doom alternative that's available. I think this really is still just a story about Jean Grey in that way that everything everybody writes is always just a story about Jean Grey. No wonder Madeline goes crazy.
See, I thought these Alpha Flight stories were just a hard look at how communism is a bad idea and capitalism is what will save us all.
Did I forget about how Canada was communist in the 80s?
Well, but just like, no, they were just like, they're talking about how you can't just make everything perfect and everyone the same because you're going to take away what makes us individually great and can achieve higher heights, if even lower lows. And I was just like, oh, great.
And now I get it. Now John Cougar Mellencamp's Little Pink Houses is playing the reelect Reagan. I see.
Yeah.
It. Okay.
Oh,
yeah.
God.
Yeah. 85, man. We're in the middle of this. I don't know. I don't know if I saw it as a incredibly Madeline and Rachel centered. I saw Rachel as the important B plot, but I thought it was far more what's her face's thing? Talisman's story, I guess.
Interesting. Okay.
And maybe kitties.
It's very Talisman centered.
I think the real story is the friends we made along the way.
It's true. And we don't need to invade Canada anymore. We did it once. It didn't work out.
Well, now, okay. I want to make a really interesting statement about this two-parter and its relationship with the rest of Asgardian Wars. Sigh. Okay. I don't think this should be considered an arc. I understand it came out around the same time. I understand there are some really strong connective threads, namely Loki being like, is it too late to own women still? Can we can we own women still? Oh, no, no. Well, I'm a villain, so too bad. I wear the horns, you know? So for me, I think of these as two very different two-part stories. And, you know, there's not really a thread that ties them together because the key element that makes that first two-parter so important is that it is in many ways, you know, really unfortunate communist anti-propaganda, but I want to think about the ways in which it's another Chris Claremont introducing ordinary people into the tumultuous world of the X-Men and the ways they get caught up in the drama that is always centered around these people. Now, of course, when we take a look at the bigger picture and we think about who Madeline Pryor really is, you know, it really depends on how you want to look at it. If you look at it at this moment as Madeline Pryor is a woman who met Scott Summers and fell in love, and she just happened to be a pilot, and these people who were on her plane, the random humans that get swept up in this whole thing, right, they are equally a part of this sort of serendipity machine that is the X-Men constantly being pulled into these situations. But I think if you look at it from the perspective of Mr. Sinister pretended to be other young boys to implicitly get uncomfortably close to Scott as a child.
Oh, God.
And pretended to be other adults to get uncomfortably close to Scott as a child, and pretended to be creepers lurking in the distance to uncomfortably watch Scott from a distance as a child. You know, all of these things come together to paint a really fucking weird picture of how this is the number one guy on Krakoa right now. But, and you know, then we ask ourselves why Scott left for the treehouse. You know, like, no wonder the guy is like, I'm going to go live in the treehouse and be Captain Krakoa, because you've literally made my boogeyman your science captain. You've made him Surgeon General. Oh, God, I can't even. But, you know, if you think about who that makes Madeline in the context of this story, it no longer has the intent that Claremont had when he wrote it. These sort of average people getting caught up in the machinations of gods and super beings. It makes it a woman who was always destined to be manipulated by a nonstop series of super powerful men in an effort to control Scott Summers at all times. It's just really weird.
It is, and I do think it's one of the things that, I said it before, there's a lot of stories that I always want them to be referenced again. You know, I was making jokes throughout the time when we were discussing Spellbound about how I really want to see all the elements from that brought into modern context. Looking at this as another thing, there are so many things here that I actually think could be really cool to bring into modern stories, but the Madeline stuff in particular makes it really difficult to think about bringing these two issues up ever again. I could see ways in which it would be kind of interesting, but it would have to be really deaf. And at this point, I think it's a fun story to read. It's a fun story to laugh about and remember, but I do kind of want to just leave it where it is in the past. This archive and relic of a time when Chris Claremont did not have the intentions for Madeline Pryor that would later show up.
So the other reason I do not want this to be repeated, is that the Alpha Flight follow-up sent Northstar to Asgard because he was an Asgardian elf, but they were drawn really like fairies. So I'm they sent him to Asgard so he could be a fairy, and they really sent Aurora on this. Right? They sent Northstar to Asgard so he could be a big fairy. Yeah, it's because he was dying of a unknown illness, which was really heavily supposed to be AIDS at the time. So I would never want this arc followed up.
I just need to point out, they're very clear that it's fairy AIDS. It's fades, if you will.
Oh, no. God. So I would say at least editorial had the idea that, hey, having Northstar come out as gay and then die of AIDS is a bad idea. So we're not going to run that story. So do something else with it. That was something editorial was really good at.
Speaking of something else that editorial is really good at, I believe that by setting this story earlier in the timeline for both the X-Men and Alpha Flight, which, by the way, when you make a crossread to do a show like this and you get to the point where you need to start reading 12 Alpha Flight in a row because of where they fall between issues of X-Men, I sometimes really think people were like, how can I make this complicated for other writers to use my character? Not to spite any specific person, but to protect your property in a world where somebody could borrow them and fuck with them. I think it forced Chris Claremont to think very carefully about how to use these characters, and it makes the fact that this was designed by editors really kind of an interesting perspective.